Welcome to Vaginas, Vulvas, and Vibrators with Jordan Donnell. This is a safe place to learn about women's health and sexual wellness. I'm your host, Jordan Donnell, physician assistant, women's sexual health educator, and intimacy coach. On this week's bonus episode, we are talking about sexual assault. April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, so I thought this was the perfect time to talk a little bit more about this. I have Madison Campbell from Lita Health joining us to share more about her company and helping bring awareness to sexual assault. Are you wanting to improve your intimacy and would like some wonderful ideas to help you? I have created the 30-Day Intimacy Challenge. To get my free 30-Day Intimacy Challenge, all you got to do is leave a review for the Vaginas, Vulvas, and Vibrators podcast. Once you do that on iTunes, take a screenshot, share it over on Instagram, and tag me, Jordan Donnell, in it. That will get you your free copy of my 30 Days of Intimacy Challenge. It is super fun. It is super juicy, and can't wait for you to try these. You can do it in whatever order you'd like, whether you'd like to do all 30 of them or pick and choose. It's up to you. Go write your review and get your 30 Days of Intimacy Challenge started right away. On this week's episode, we have Madison Campbell joining us. She is the founder of Lita Health. The mission of Lita Health is to empower survivors of sexual assault in an effort to better serve survivors. Madison, do you want to go ahead and tell us a little bit more about yourself and Lita Health?
Yeah, so Lita Health was kind of this brainchild of mine from an experience that I had. I think a lot of companies nowadays, companies, nonprofits, whatever, initiatives, are started by folks that have an innate experience with it and one day wake up and say, I am tired of looking at how the world is working and I want to do something better. So Leda in Greek mythology was Helen of Troy's mother who was raped by Zeus. A famous, you know, kind of mythological mother. It's very strong, but unfortunately Zeus raped her. And out of that rape created Helen of Troy, who was obviously a very strong woman and persevered and was the face at something, a thousand ships, something like that. I don't know. I'm bad at this. But we named the company after that because oftentimes as survivors of sexual assault or rape, you can't tell anybody what happened to you, but you can tell another survivor, right? Maybe you can't tell your parents, maybe you can't tell your friends, you don't know how they'll judge you, but you can tell another person who's been through it. So that's kind of where Lita comes from. And Lita came into this world from this view that I had that things were just not working, frankly speaking. When you have the majority of people, at least in my life and in my extended family, have some sort of sexual assault, rape, domestic violence, sexual harassment that's gone on in their life, I would consider that a pandemic, in my opinion. Probably more people have suffered at the hands of gender-based violence than COVID at this point. I think that's a really scary thing to talk about, but COVID has so much attention on it. Why are we putting more attention on kind of this, you know, big topic of gender-based violence? I decided to start this company with doing a couple different things to really create the resources that were not there for me whenever I was sexually assaulted. The first resource being a sexual assault evidence collection kit for at-home use, and then a multitude of different services that kind of surround that. So medical care, teletherapy, you know, prophylactics, basically bringing care into the home, which telemedically speaking has been around for the last 5 to 10 years for a lot of other diseases and a lot of other very vulnerable patient populations that can't leave the house. The one vulnerable population that can't leave the house often is immobilized, right? Like myself and 77% of people nationally and 90 to 95% on college campuses is sexual assault survivors. And so where Lita comes in is looking at closing that gap of care, because the majority, not the minority, are the folks that aren't receiving care. And those are the population that we should be focusing on, not just really making the 15 to 20% of people seeking care super comfortable. They already have the resources, right? The resources are out there. what resources aren't out there are for the populations that never make it to, you know, the hospital, to the police, or even to a clinic.
Absolutely. And I think so many people, so many women in particular, are affected by sexual assault and don't ever come forward, don't ever tell anybody, and just brush it underneath and move on and bury their trauma. And it eventually, I think, resurfaces in their life at some other point.
100%. It's one of those things where you go through each day, you think it's normal. And then, I don't know, this was something that happened to me, but after a sexual assault, having consensual sex again is sometimes very difficult because you can be triggered. And even like, I'm 3 years, you know, into a relationship right now, and there are still some times where my mind will just flash and I'll remember something and it'll totally take me out. And so it's not only years where that trauma comes back, but it's also when you start having like good consensual sex again that you sometimes remember the times that it was really, really bad.
Absolutely. So this month is Sexual Assault Prevention Month when we are launching the episode. And I want to know a little bit more about how common is sexual assault, sexual harassment?
Yeah, extremely common. So in college, 1 in 4 college students will be sexually assaulted during their 4 years of college. Which, if we think about the lifetime rate of getting cancer, which I believe is 1 in 6, that's in 4 years, you have a higher chance in your lifetime chance of getting cancer. The statistic usually is 1 in 4, although recently it's been more 1 in 3. And then 1 in 5 women in their lifetime will experience sexual assault. So that's a big amount. And then the populations that we primarily deal with, which are the BIPOC population, LGBTQ, undocumented immigrants, right, who really are not seeking care. Also Indigenous folks who are on reservations who often don't seek care. But that number is going to go up significantly from there. So really the most vulnerable populations are at such a high rate of having gender-based violence against them. But in general, across the population, both men and women are looking at that 1 in 4, 1 in 5 chance of getting sexually assaulted during their lifetime.
I didn't realize that it's more common ultimately than cancer. And we're not making a big deal about it. Like this in our society, it's just, oh, it happens.
I don't know. I still have not figured out why we are so indifferent to the fact that so many people are getting sexually assaulted, because it's one of those things where on a one-to-one conversation, say with an older man who has daughters, even if maybe they had some crazy times in college and they weren't always the most consensual, usually when they have a daughter, you can talk to them about this and they understand it and they want to protect their daughter. So I think there's a generational shift. I think as more people become parents, realizing that they don't want their daughters and sons to experience the same amount of violence that they did, hopefully will create a culture change. But I also think it's going to be this next generation, the millennial generation and Gen Z or the Generation Zoom, that are standing up and saying enough is enough. And I'm going to create the world that I want to live in. And that happens to be a world where we actually talk about consent.
Absolutely. And that's actually something I wanted to talk about today is consent, because I think that when it comes to sexual assault, it's not necessarily what people see. Oh, you were kidnapped and raped. That's not always the case. A lot of times it's you were out with your friends. There was too much drinking involved. You didn't consent to sexual activity. And then sex occurs. And then you, at least for me, you process it as something that you did. Not that they were a predator or an attacker.
I think the interesting thing too is that 80% of all sexual assaults are somebody you know. So this whole like notion of media where, like you said, someone kidnaps you or gets you in the parking garage realistically is not happening. And I often say this, that you could see someone who is just sexually assaulted walking down a street and you would not know the difference between anyone else, because the majority of times people are not harmed, bleeding out, anything like that. They just experienced something that was deeply psychologically troubling that happened to their body. And they're just trying to move through life, trying to get through it. But realistically speaking, this rogue sexual assailant who's doing all this kind of crazy stuff, you don't need to do that because most survivors, most victims of sexual assault will freeze up during the moment and just take it, right? It's like this psychological hold. You don't even fight. And so you're not seeing a lot of fighting happening. For me, certainly, I did not fight. I did not I tried to get away at the very beginning and try to say no, no, no. Once I realized it was happening, it was this weird thing of saying, well, as a woman, you kind of know the most vulnerable time to get out of a situation like this is after he comes, right? And so if you can just get him to that point, you can get away. Like that was what was happening in my mind.
Absolutely. And I think that a lot of women, initially, I think some women may try to get away, you know, say no. But then when you realize you can't get away, you're just like, okay, well, let's make this as fast as possible, get it over with, and then I can get out of this situation.
Yeah. I think in general, victims and survivors, you have a lot of adrenaline pumping through you. And in general, you can kind of think like, what is going to be my out here? And you get really strong. Like you do get really strong. You get very methodical. You get very, okay, I'm going to have to deal with this. And this is what I'm going to do afterwards. And I'm going to shower and I'm going to do this, right? Everything. You're thinking about the next steps and your mind also goes blank during it. So years later, survivors, including myself, will have like dissociative amnesia where you just won't remember like instances. Like I remember the beginning and I remember the aftermath and I don't remember kind of what came like in between. And usually during the event, you're just kind of like disassociating because your brain is like, this is too traumatic. Like, I'm not going to be here for this. Bye-bye. I'll see you later.
Yeah, you actually brought up a good point about showering. So if you are going to report your sexual assault, is showering something that you want to avoid?
Yeah, so that's the problem. So if you do want to get evidence taken, so whether that's in a hospital or using one of our kits eventually, your goal should be not to shower, not to brush your teeth, try not to use the restroom, try not to do anything, because that is going to lose DNA, lose sperm, lose everything. And so it's this weird thing where your natural body's reaction is to go and shower away everything. And in reality, in forensics, by showering away everything, you're also showering away evidence of what happened to you. So yes, it's this horrible thing to have to tell someone that you want to sit in your filth until you do something. But that's the harsh reality is if you do have evidence collection on your mind and want to, you know, preserve what happened to you and have evidence, because people will victim blame. They won't believe you. Unfortunately, that's the way the world works. You're going to want to kind of preserve your body like a crime scene almost. And what we're trying to do at LITA is make that a better, you know, experience than what currently exists, right? Right now, you have to go to a hospital, you have to wait. Sometimes you're turned away. There's a lack of sexual assault nurse examiners. 4 to 8 hours long in terms of an examination, like all this very arduous stuff. You know, we're trying to dilute that down to a 15-minute process. So hopefully we'll create this culture change that everybody is kind of their own forensic scientist that knows how to, you know, do this type of evidence collection. But right now we're kind of living in a world where there's really only one thing to do, and that's to go to a hospital. And so if you're going to a hospital, your goal should be to try to preserve yourself as much as humanly possible.
Perfect. So in the event you get sexually assaulted, what should somebody's next steps be?
So I think it's hard because every single person is going to be in a different place after their trauma. I think the biggest thing is, one, immediately taking care of the medical needs you have as soon as possible. So I know we talked about it's not often that this stranger rape or this very aggression, you know, type thing happens where you're bleeding or anything like that. But if you have wounds, if you're bleeding, if you're injured, the first thing on your mind should be seeking medical attention. Evidence collection can always come later. But I think the first thing is basically triaging yourself like you were in any accident, right? of how do I get myself to that point where at least I'm medically okay. So even with what we're doing is we're triaging people and saying, are you hurt? Are you injured? Here's a hospital. Here's 911. So I think that that's like a first thing to talk about is like triaging yourself, really asking yourself those questions. And then getting to a point where you're trying to decide what you would like to do. And unfortunately, this is where the hospital like examination can be very scary, because at that point, you oftentimes are, if you go to a hospital, will be surrounded by police that will also be questioning you. And specifically in the communities like the BIPOC community, right, this trust of police is very limited. And having to tell a sexual assault survivor who's in specifically a minority group that you should immediately go and talk to the police about this is like a non-starter. Like, that's just a non-starter. Why would you ever say that? And so I think at that point, you really want to go into your mind, and hopefully we'll have a lot of education materials on this as well as providing these alternatives. But really go in your mind about, what do I want to do moving forward? Do I see justice in this criminal sense? And if I do think that I want to get my assailant in jail, then really it's about preserving evidence, doing a report, and going to the police. Most people after their assault are not immediately thinking like, I want my assailant in jail. It's more like, I want myself to be okay. And so at that point, it's triaging yourself for medical care, going and seeing a doctor, if at all possible, or using telemedical, using different services, as well as just writing down what happened. Even if you have a note on your phone or photos or anything like that, keeping a log of everything you remember as it starts, you know, it's very fresh in your mind, is very important. So you kind of have to start putting all this stuff together, assuming that we live, unfortunately, in a world which moving forward past this point after the assault will be fraught with every single like person will fight you. Did this happen? Was it a he said, she said? All this kind of stuff. Was it consensual? And so what you basically have to start doing is start recording everything. And if you can't do an evidence collection kit in a hospital, even getting like tissues and taking it, Q-tips that are probably just in your bathroom, anything, right? MacGyvering your own way to collect anything until you're ready to move forward, you know? And that's one of those things that every survivor is going to think differently. And of course, if you're thinking, I know exactly what I want to do, I know this process, go for it. But unfortunately, I think most people are stunted, like I was, after the assault. And so the goal should be just put down everything you remember, try to collect as much as humanly possible, and try to triage yourself to make sure you're okay. Because in the days after, you'll be able to get more help, right? There's more people you can reach out to. There's more hotlines. There's more things that you can Google about what to do next. But in those first pivotal hours, you unfortunately kind of have to think very clearly and make a lot of quick decisions on what do I want the next process to be.
Right. And you don't plan for, I'm going to be sexually assaulted and I need to have this plan in my head of what happens after the fact. Like, it's not something that you're thinking about expecting.
It's like a car crash, right? Like if you're driving and you get in a car crash, you're not thinking of what to do next. However, you kind of have some notion, right? Like, I don't know that much about the legal system of like car crashes, but I know that if I got in a car crash, I would get out. I would ask for his insurance. I would try to take photos of my car. I would try to like call 911. I would do all these things. And so even if you've never prepared for this event, I think innately humans kind of know the general steps that they need to take. And when that adrenaline is rushing through you, you can triage a little bit of a way. I think in general, there needs to be a lot more education on a broader scale of like, what does it mean for, like, imagine if every single high school student was taught about evidence collection, not only what psychological deterrent would that do to young men who, you know, don't understand consent because they now know that women can finally take evidence and they're in the power. But also it's like, you just need to get to the point where you're okay, you're getting through it. And knowing that there are companies and folks like us that are actively trying to educate the public on what to do next. And eventually we will create the culture change that we want to see.
Could you imagine a world where in high school or middle school, we're taught about consent and we're taught about all of that. Do you know how crazy that would be? I think that would be wonderful.
I can imagine a world like that, but I don't know how fast it will take. The reason why we started this company as a company and not just me going and lobbying to change the government is because historically speaking, it just takes a long time to make meaningful change from the legislation, right? Especially when you're dealing with a lot of legislators and people in power who have instances of their own. And so that's kind of what I think about this. It's like, yes, it would be great if we, for instance, had a federal law that mandated consent training. How are we going to get that passed if we continuously have administration which has sexual assault allegations against them, you know? So I want to believe that things will eventually get better, but I think it's going to take a huge societal change on both like the government side and human nature side. And maybe it's just convincing like gym teachers, like your gym teacher from high school to say, hey, let's put this in, even if it's not mandated by the state.
Right. Somebody has to see the value in it to make sure that their students are at least educated. And that's where it starts. So what is consent? Can we talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. Consent is a very interesting thing. And I kind of want to talk about it in the terms of sexual assault. So consent is this amazing, awesome thing that when you have it, it just feels really, really great. And it makes the experience so much better because it's this notion of getting direct approval and understanding that we're both on the same page about what we want and what we don't want. What I think is a good example of consent at the highest degree in the community where I've seen consent discussed more than any other community is the BDSM community, where oftentimes, and the BDSM community will have so many roles up front, so many discussions about what makes sense, what doesn't make sense. And you could be dripping hot wax on somebody and have like third degree burns and slaps on your face and, you know, crazy lashes on your back. And that could be consensual, right? And so the reason why I bring that up is oftentimes people equate sexual assault to this notion of being injured or harmed. And in reality, when we think about one of the most consensual relationships that exists out there, which is the BDSM community, those can exhibit sometimes this vision of harm, yet that is one of the most consensual things. And the reason why I want to paint that picture is because it paints a picture that consent is highly psychological and it's not based off of actions, right? So it's not based off of like, oh, I see someone who's injured. That must have not been a consensual experience. It's this highly psychological thing of discussion of saying, I like this, I don't like this, and kind of being on even playing field. It's just like getting a job for the first time. You're getting a job, you're getting a contract, you're saying, I like this, I don't like this, I agree with this, I don't agree with this, you know, and then you're working every single day to make with the things that you set up at the very beginning of the arrangement. And that's something that I think is really important in talking about consent is this agreement between two parties or multiple parties that we're coming into this. We want to have a fun time because sex can be absolutely amazing and great. And these are the limitations that I have. And that's why I think like the BDSM community is a great kind of look at that because they discuss it more than anyone else.
I would agree with that. The BDSM kink community is a wonderful role model for how to get consent. And I know I have more podcasts coming up about BDSM and kink specifically, and consent will be covered in there as well. But yeah, that's a great example.
It's great. It's absolutely great. And I was part of, before I became very boring and monogamous, which I currently am, I tried to get into the kink community a lot. And I really liked it. Like, it was just so different in terms of the transparency than normal relationships or like the random finance guys I would match with on Tinder.
I love that. But you're right. It's a very different community. And it's very like warm and welcoming, I think. I hate to ask this question this way, but I feel like unfortunately in our society that we live in, we have to ask this question. As a woman, what are some ways to protect ourselves from sexual assault?
Yeah. And so it's such a shitty question, right? Because what we should be asking is, how do we inform those folks that perpetrate harm on how to perpetrate harm? My mother sent me off to college with mace. I tell you, that did not make me feel safe at all. And I don't drink alcohol, not because I don't really like alcohol, like not because I'm like, oh, bad alcohol or it does all these bad things. I'm just like a wuss when it comes to alcohol. Like, I literally can't stand the taste. I know people are like, oh, you'll get over the taste and then it'll taste good. It never tastes good, ever. It never tastes good to me. So I was one of those folks in college that was completely like green in terms of like no alcohol, had mace, didn't dress inappropriately, quote unquote, grew up very Catholic, all this kind of stuff. And it still happened to me. So I think this notion of dressing well or like carrying mace or like not drinking or all this kind of stuff, I think it's wrong. I think the biggest thing that I would say is like, I think where I went wrong is ignoring red flags where I knew there were red flags. And I think oftentimes we as women ignore red flags because we want to give people the benefit of the doubt. But with the story that you were telling me right before we started this, a guy sending you an inappropriate photo out of the blue, like that's a big red flag, right? And I think that we as women get these big red flags, you know? And they might be in the shape or form of an inappropriate photo or a weird text or like a weird location that they want to meet at or late at night, far away from your house or all this kind of stuff. And I think that that's kind of where the majority of things are happening that we should just be a little bit more aware of. And so if I were to look back at like, why did half the situations that happened to me happen when I was in college, it was because I saw the red flags and I ignored it and gave those folks the benefit of the doubt. And now that I'm a little bit more like beaten up, like a chip on my shoulder, it's more like I don't trust people as easily. And that's okay once they gain my trust and then they kind of have it forever. But I think being a little bit untrusting of folks' motives, unfortunately, is kind of what you have to do, and not ignoring those red flags.
I think that's the best advice ever. And I would totally agree that I've ignored red flags. And then you put yourself in situations that you know probably were not the best situation. And now you're there.
Yeah. And you know, we're not stupid. Like, women are not stupid. We've been through everything. Like, we give birth, we get our period. We go through it all. We know how to handle ourselves, and we still give ourselves the benefit of the doubt that things are going to be okay. And so that's the biggest thing, is like to tell my like 20-year-old self is like, don't, like when a guy invites you to his car in a parking lot, like to have sex, like, ignore that, Madison. Like, probably not a good idea. Like, not a good person, you know? And there's this weird thing about being like, oh, but he likes me and he thinks I'm pretty and he does this, he does that. And you kind of ignore those things. But I, now looking back on it, I know all those moments, I can track them back, and they all track back to one or two moments where I was like, not good. And I just completely ignored it.
Yeah. And I think it's important to also note that like, this doesn't make women at fault at all for what has happened to them. Just because we see the red flags and don't necessarily listen to our intuition about the red flags does not mean that it is our fault.
Of course not. And I've been like 3 years out since anything even remotely relating to like gender-based violence, other than sexual harassment, which I think I get online all the time, but like remotely based off of like people touching me inappropriately or doing anything like that. It's been like 3 years. And it's because I'm in this like amazing relationship where we often talk about boundaries, we talk about red flags, and we're very transparent with each other. So I think these things can exist. I think these relationships can, you know, persevere, and you can get together with someone who's going to help point out weird behavior even when you can't see it. And so there was some training on my boyfriend's part where he had to be like, Madison, that's not good behavior. And as much as I didn't want to hear it, he was right.
That's awesome that you have somebody supportive to help you see that. in my like dating life, it's been so helpful just to have men who point out like, hey, this is what you're doing. Like, it's awesome to be surrounded by people who help you see what's going on. Now, what are some signs to look for in a predator?
I know I use the word like assailant and predator and things like that, but oftentimes this is like a very weird statistic, but oftentimes folks who perpetrate harm against someone else are survivors themselves who are only perpetrating harm because that's kind of what they know, whether or not they were sexually assaulted as a child. It's very interesting that there is a cycle of abuse where folks that have been abused will sometimes commit abuse again because that's all they know. And so I think some of the signs that you can look for is a repressed understanding of sex, you know, not really a full understanding of having relationships, sexual relationships, dating, anything like that. In all the times where I've had those moments, it's been with men that have kind of been a little bit backwards in terms of consent because they just didn't know any better. Right? Like the person who I was sexually assaulted by, I don't think ever really had girlfriends or anything like that. And I know that he wasn't dating folks. And, you know, kind of this behavior of like not really understanding boundaries because no one ever taught him that. Like that was actually kind of, and when I look throughout my life of the really weird situations that happened to me, it's been mostly that. Now, of course, there has been folks that are more like the serial frat guys constantly doing this, not realizing the wrongs. And you're going to, in terms of red flags, like, you know, that, and you're going to hear rumors and you're going to understand what that's happening. But I think where this secretive folks that commit harm that no one is expecting is those folks who are a little backwards in terms of dating, in terms of, you know, communication with the other sex and communication with how that works. And oftentimes the things that have kind of happened to me have also happened under the guise of the person drinking too much or having too much substances. And so I think there's a notion too of like this notion of I have been repressed. I don't really understand consent. I never got educated on it. Plus substances is like a no-go. Like it's a complete no-go.
Yeah. And I think for me, like my situations have involved football players. And I think in that situation, they're used to getting what they want and don't understand the word no, or they don't comprehend that for some reason.
Yeah, I try to stay away from like wealthy boys. They tend to not understand anyone telling them no for any reason. Maybe that's like a good thing, is like as a precautionary measure to try telling a man multiple times no and see how they react to it. And if they react well to being told multiple times, no, sorry, no, sorry, no, sorry, and they don't freak out about it, that's probably a good sign.
That sounds like a great test. I like that. So a few weeks ago, you posted on social media about many women not reporting or not realizing that they were assaulted initially. And I think that so many women can relate to that. And that's why a lot of women don't report until years down the road, which you see in media currently, yeah. All of these people coming forward later on. What are some reasons why women don't report right away?
That goes back to like this notion of sexual harassment, right? That it's like, if you really think about this notion of sexual harassment, you'll think about all the times where these people go into the media, they talk about, oh, so-and-so politician did this. And it's, oh, at a holiday party, asked me if he wanted to play like strip poker or push me up against a wall or tried to kiss me. If you were to put all those instances into a diary, I would have tons of them, like so many. And you just ignore it because you don't really think like it was that meaningful, because we're in, unfortunately, this culture where we're told to deal with it. Same with sexual assault. If you as a person have so many experiences, some good, some bad, it's very difficult to kind of take away all the bad, because oftentimes there's just so much bad. There's so much bad. And so this notion of not reporting, I find when I talk to survivors, is this notion of just not feeling like their story was anything out of the ordinary, because the culture of sex right now is not that great. And so where I think a lot of folks are not reporting or not moving forward or not even realizing what happened to them was sexual assault. I think it comes back to this notion of this culture around sex is so horrible that it's sometimes even difficult to say, oh, when someone pushes you against the wall and you say no, like that is sexual assault. And I think if we have more explanation, more people listening to this, thinking about scenarios in their head, they will start to realize that they've had more instances of non-consensual stuff than consensual in reality. But it's going to take this notion of realization and talking about it and saying those stories loud so that folks like me, the only reason why I spoke up is because I read stories from the Me Too movement. I said, oh my God, that sounds like my story. And so I think the only way that we kind of change this is constantly sharing our stories so other women can say, oh my God, that happened to me, and then realize that what happened to them was actually assault or harassment.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think that some women also don't report because they are already burying it deep down and don't want to re-bring that up and deal with that trauma again. And I think some women also don't report because they want to protect the other person and don't necessarily want to hurt their future, I guess is the best way to put that.
Or hurt. Yeah. And the amount of power that if you collect evidence, you've proof, you have witnesses, you have all this kind of stuff, you could essentially ruin someone's life. It is a very big thing. And that's why I think shifting the cultural framework about, oh, I don't want to ruin this person's life, and shifting it to what we're doing, which we call transformative justice, which is basically talking about what we talked about before, which is most of those predators, quote unquote, are folks that have actually had harm committed to them and they're perpetrating this cycle of harm. And so rather than saying those folk belong in a jail ostracized, it's about actually having them accountable and getting them therapy and help to realize what they did was wrong. Because it's education, it's talking about consent, right? And so until then, we really have to transform this notion of justice. And I think that our world is going to be very different if we can get this shape around, you know, that one guy who was your friend, who just crossed this boundary and didn't understand it because he was too drunk that night, doesn't belong to rot in a jail cell with his college education down the career, his sports, all that kind of stuff, right? You know, what he deserves is education about what happened. And honestly, if my assailant, and maybe one day after all this, you know, will come out and say sorry, that would be the end of my cycle. It's just his accountability and saying sorry, and that I will never do this again. And I truly, profoundly apologize. And so that's what I think we need to get to, is this profound accountability between all parties. And that also means women too, because there are moments, and I can think about moments in my life, where I have not explicitly asked consent from men. And so we are not completely the victims in this. It's going to take accountability from both ends, a lot of expression of consent, and for us to realize that we can also perpetrate harm against men.
Yeah, I think that's really good. And you're absolutely right. I know, like, for me, the reason why I didn't report, like, I didn't want them to go to jail. But if they had the opportunity to be educated and informed of why this is wrong, and I'm sorry, I'm not going to be the one to do that. I'm not going to go back to that individual and say something. But if they had the opportunity to be informed of how their behaviors were inappropriate, how to prevent that in the future, that would have been sufficient for me, I guess you could say. And
yeah, it's not your job to get them to be accountable. It's your job to tell someone else to say, hey, this person hurt me. I'm putting this out in the open and I want them to get help. And it's for an organization that realizes that there's two sides of the coin to provide that help. And unfortunately, I think the criminal justice system and putting people in small jail cells is not creating rehabilitation for those folks or any folks really, but I mean, I'm a little bit of prison abolitionist here, but I think that's not how we get people on the right side of life, right? Why should we tell people that they're evil just simply because they didn't understand consent growing up because they were never taught it, right? There's so many things in life like folks that grow up in very backwards churches, right? That like Westboro Baptists that are very against LGBTQ and very against like BIPOC communities. If you grow up and you're indoctrinated into those churches, you're not going to realize what, you know, the behavior is wrong because it's the only behavior you know. And same at consent at a very high level is we have indoctrinated people to an extent with not understanding consent. And I know I grew up very Catholic. It was an abstinence only type of education. I just flew out to Utah and was talking to folks, abstinence only. And so to tell folks that are taught this at such a young age, that this is like how we deal with sex and stuff like that, and then to experience real life and fault them for not being educated on this or not self-educating is also wrong. There's just a big education problem that we are missing here.
That's what I'm finding by doing this podcast. A lot of stuff is a educational lack of information for everybody. You're good.
100%.
So this has been so informative. I think the listeners are going to absolutely love this episode. And I want to know, what kind of resources do you have out there for survivors of sexual assault?
Yeah, so I'm super excited. And I want all listeners to know these are completely free. I'm super excited to talk about this. So we offer healing circles. What is a healing circle, you may ask? So very similar to a support group. It's 6 to 8 folks. And what we do is we find facilitators that deal primarily with the identity of the survivor group. So we have male identifying survivors with facilitators that completely understand, right, that type of sexual gender-based violence, which oftentimes is very different than female identifying survivors. We have a queer identifying survivor group. We have BIPOC identifying survivor group, as well as art healing survivor group. So using art as a way to heal from sexual assault, as well as we're about to do drama therapy, which is really great. And so we're doing very holistic services because we found that this notion of cognitive behavioral therapy in terms of this is the only way, this is one way of doing it, doesn't often work for survivors. So what we're trying to do is build this very holistic healing where not only are we putting you in with a group of survivors that have a very similar identity to you versus kind of like this, here's a bunch of people in this group who are going to come at different, because honestly speaking, the woman who's undocumented, who couldn't go to the police because she was afraid of being deported, who was sexually assaulted, is very different than the upper middle class white woman, right? And I fall into the upper middle class white woman in terms of privilege. And myself and that identity is very different of how I experience trauma and how I heal from trauma. And so finding a facilitator that understands both is incredibly important. And that's what we're doing in our healing circles. I'll send you a link that you can send out, but it's lita.co/healing circles. Completely free to sign up. You're going to get 8 weeks long of amazing therapy, and we've seen amazing results from it.
That is awesome. I love that. And I like the way you split the groups up because I think that you're absolutely right in that different populations will experience and can relate differently to more similar people.
It's just like this one size fits all mentality doesn't work, right? And so we've just seen it doesn't work. We talk to survivors. We know it doesn't work. And so provide them with something that does work. And what, you know, does work is finding facilitators that they can look at and say, they look like me and they understand my experience because they've lived it, and not this random privileged white woman coming in to say, oh, I'm so sorry this happened to you. When meanwhile, you've been given everything in life, right? It's just a very different, it's experiences, it's culture. And those are the things that we're trying to build into a very holistic way of healing.
I love that. Where can the listeners find you at?
Yep. I would love if folks follow us, both myself and our company on Twitter and Instagram. My username is Martyr Dyson, MartyrDison. And then everything else is Lita Health. So follow us. We provide lots of educational content. We'll provide lots of information in our bio about healing circles. And also, I'm very active on Twitter. So feel free to reach out to me. Tell me your story. If I can do anything to help, I will.
Awesome. And I will put all of those links in the show notes so that they can easily find you. Well, amazing. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And this has been so wonderful. So thank
you. Yay!
This episode is sponsored by Pure Romance by Jordan Jones, offering top bath and beauty products and relationship enhancement items. Check out the link in the bio to start shopping today. By shopping, you are supporting this podcast. Thank you for joining today and continuing to bring awareness to women's health. If you love the show, please subscribe so you never miss another episode and leave a review for others to see. If you want to see me on the daily, you can check out my bio for links to all my pages. Be sure to share this episode with your girlfriends. Thanks again and see you next episode.